I will call to order the joint meeting between the House Government Operations and Elections Policy Committee with the Senate Government Finance and Policy and Elections Committee. Members, thank you for being here today. The purpose for our meeting today is the Campaign Finance Board here in the state of Minnesota is considering some rulemaking and promulgating rules, and we have discussed, as Chair Kiffmeyer and myself, that it might be a good idea to be able to have everyone that's on the committees that have jurisdiction in the legislature be briefed by Mr. Jeff Sigurdson, who is the Executive Director of the Campaign Finance Board. And in your packet, members, there are the three separate rules that the board is considering promulgation of rules. And this is an informational meeting. No action will be taken by either committee today from the House or the Senate. And as a part of that process as well, we are not anticipating taking any or have provisions for taking public input, since it is an informational meeting today, to bring you, the members of the various committees, up to speed on where the Campaign Finance Board is at on the process. And I think what we'll do is we will have discussion and presentation and discussion on each of the three rules separately, and then when we're done with that, with the presentation and questions, then we'll move on to the next, and so on and so forth. And so, Mr. Sigurdson, I didn't clear that with you in advance, but I suspect that that's a workable, or maybe what you were anticipating as well. Mr. Sigurdson, welcome to the committee. Introduce yourself, and if you want to just comment on that methodology, if that works for you.
Sure. Mr. Chair, thank you for having me here.
Mr. Sigurdson, if you pull the mic a little closer there.
Sure. I'll get a little closer, too. My name, again, is Jeff Sigurdson. I'm the Executive Director of the Campaign Finance Board. Maybe to follow the pattern, I'm from the city of Burnsville. However, all the representatives can relax. Representative Christensen is my representative, but Senator Hall... There we go.
With you.
I would like to... I would actually, Chair Driscoll, if it's all right with you, the three packets of rules take some time to go through. Now, obviously, I'm not going to go through on them on a line-by-line basis, but if there's a point where there's a question, rather than hear me drone on for 30 minutes in a row, it'd be just fine with me if somebody wanted to interrupt me at that point if the question came to their mind. But it's, of course, up to you.
Mr. Sigurdson, I think we're on the same page. I was thinking that we would take them, not that you would present all of them, then we would back up to the first rule that you're considering promulgating. They would take them as rules, and then as people had questions as it came up, we would go from that.
Yes,
and Senator Kiffmeyer, does that work for you as well?
Yes, it does. Members, just so that it's a set, there are three sets of rules that you have in your packet. So, Mr. Sigurdson, when you do present, let's make sure that, because they kind of look the same.
Sure.
So let's always make sure that every member has the set that you're currently on.
With that, Mr. Sigurdson, if you'll go ahead and proceed with the first one, and I go ahead and identify which one we're going to look at first.
Sure. Members, with your permission, I'm going to take about 2 minutes to explain how we got to this, into the administrative rule process, and then quickly get into the rules in specific. The board was presented with a petition to address or adopt administrative rules dealing with independent expenditures in April of 2016. That was presented to the board by George Beck, who is the chair of the Minnesota Citizens for Clean Elections. At that time, the board declined because it was going into an election year, and we knew at that point that Mr. Goldsmith was stepping down as executive director. So it was thought more appropriate, one, to wait for the election to be over, and two, to have a new executive director in place before addressing administrative rules. In October of 2016, the board decided to move forward with both looking at the petition as submitted by Mr. Beck, but also instructing staff to go back and look at what there may be in terms of catch-up or administrative rule topics that haven't been dealt with by the board in quite a while. The fact is that the board rarely does administrative rules. In 2014, under direct direction from the legislature, the board adopted expedited rules dealing with investigations conducted by the board. But on its own initiative, the last time that the board did administrative rules was 2006, which is on the submission of electronic reports. And prior to that, 2002, when there was a fairly lengthy set of rules done on lobbying, on the way in which lobbyists report to the board the various disbursements they have as they lobby public officials. So there was a bit of a backlog, including a number of advisory opinions. And I bring up advisory opinions quickly just because as I'm going through the material, I'm going to be referencing advisory opinions and how that influences the drafting of administrative rule by the board. The statute 1002 provides that the board should, at any time that it adopts an advisory opinion that it believes has a wider application than just to the individual or association who asked the question, that it should adopt an administrative rule. And there was a backlog of those because, again, we don't do administrative rules very often. We went back, found that there were quite a few that clearly would apply to not only to the individual who asked the question, but to any individual who found himself in a similar circumstance. And so based on that, there were a number of administrative rules based on advisory opinions issued prior by the board. In terms of the approach taken by the board, we're very early in the process. The board decided to form a subcommittee to look at administrative rules and appointed two board members who are both here today, Mr. Moylanen and former Representative Peggy Lepik. Mr. Moylanen is self-identified with the DFL party. Representative Lepik was a member with the Republican Party. They were to, again, provide us with their perspective as staff developed rules on those subjects which had been brought to us and which we had identified as being appropriate for development. Nonetheless, we wanted to make this very much a public process, not just staff and board members. And so we've conducted six different hearings at which over nine individuals have submitted, I believe it's 15 different sets of written comments to the board, and those have all been taken into consideration. If you go to our website, there's a rulemaking docket that starts at the beginning of this process and then goes up through, I believe, September 20th was the last board meeting, the last subcommittee hearing on rules, at which point the subcommittee believes that it's finished with its task and it's now ready to take that set of subjects that it's identified back to the full board at the October 4th meeting. At that point, the full board will vote on whether or not there's anything that they wish to go forward with from that packet. Any, all, or none of those rules would be appropriate for consideration. If they'd agree to do so, then at that point we would start the more formal process, which includes another 60-day comment period for the public and members of the legislature, as far as that goes, to provide comment back to the board and see if there are other issues that we should address or should modify. Initially, there were four groups of rules, three of which are still before us here, which I'll be going over. The fourth group of rules was actually adopted into legislation through a bill authored by Senator Kiffmeyer. This was then codified as part of Chapter 4 at the legislative special session. So that simply reduced the amount of rule subjects that the board was looking at, and then we went forward from there. This is not to say that the administrative rules are necessarily going to be the only, communication from the board to the legislature. What is unknown to me at this point is that the board is also considering the possibility of a legislative recommendation package to bring to you. Certainly, I've had discussions with various members of the legislature who have brought up issues that are clearly outside the scope of administrative rules. And indeed, during the process of developing these rules, Mr. Moylanen and Ms. Lepik have found issues which they basically realized were of interest to them, could very well address issues that would be of value to the regulated community, but were, again, clearly outside the scope of administrative rules. And I'll leave it to them if they wish to discuss that. But there may be some areas that they would be that they'll be suggesting to the board would be, again, a legislative recommendation package for you at the next session. The first packet of rules that we were looking at, it's titled at the top, Draft Disclaimer and Non-Expenditure Provisions, and the first one is 4501.0100. You will notice that there are some comments on the side. This is the material that we provide on our website, and realizing that members of the public who come to this may not understand what we're trying to accomplish here or why the language is changing as we go along, staff does put in comments based, again, on the decision of the subcommittee as to what these rules should look like and some changes as time has gone by. The first part, 4501, just is looking at definitions. To a certain extent, I'm just going to skip over this. The definitions are used later so that we can reference specific rules and relate them to the provisions of Chapter 10A. But one of the definitions, 4501.0200 on securities, which you see at the bottom of page 1, is a little bit more significant. This is the issue of what securities need to be listed on the economic interest statement that U.S. public officials and local officials need to provide, and then which eventually is reported on an EIS statement to the board. It was understood that the whole purpose of this is to provide meaningful disclosure to the public, namely, is there the potential of a conflict of interest over the personal financial holdings of the public official versus the public's right to know? This is acknowledging the idea that an EIS statement is, in fact, an invasion of any public official's privacy. You're looking at information that you're not necessarily going to want to give up, but it's given under the understanding that this is how the public is reassured that there is no question about public officials taking an action simply for their own benefit, and in fact that the greater public good is being served here, and that we can identify any particular source of a conflict of interest. Looking at the definitions, there were a few things, though, that the committee decided really didn't apply to that. For example, mutual funds. In the past, and or currently, you're required to list any mutual fund on your disclosure statement if that mutual fund has a value of over $2,500. Now, as you recall, you don't list the value, you don't list the number of shares in that mutual fund, but you have to list the fact that you have an investment of over $2,500 in a mutual fund. The nature of mutual funds is that it's extremely unlikely that you know what the holdings are of that mutual fund at any time. They literally hold hundreds, sometimes thousands of individual stocks and bonds, and a public official really isn't going to know what's in them at any particular time. It's extremely unlikely that it could be the possibility of a conflict of interest based on holding a mutual fund. Therefore, it's been removed in this set of draft rules as something that needs to be disclosed on the EIS statement. Similarly, if you look towards the back, you'll see that there's an exception now for blind trust. And the current approach, if you had a blind trust, there was some debate, it's not clear in the rules at least, as to whether or not you were supposed to disclose those holdings held within the blind trust, which if you think about it, simply doesn't make any sense. You're not supposed to know what's in a blind trust. So we've made it specific that would not be included in the list of items that you disclose in your EIS statement. Now, there is some movement towards including a couple of things. For example, annuities are listed. If you have an annuity, you need to list that, although the underlying disclosure of that annuity, i.e. the investments held by the annuity, are not provided. This is on the idea that there was a discussion on that. We've certainly had feedback with the thought that maybe annuities don't need to be listed at all. But because annuities are heavily regulated by the state, and there is the opportunity for public officials to influence whether or not particular annuities can be sold in the state, and also whether or not there should be an investigation, for example, the Attorney General had a long investigation on the selling of annuities. It did seem to the subcommittee that it would be appropriate to leave annuities in there, but again, not try to get to the underlying disclosure of what an annuity may hold at any given time. And that again will also bring me to the point or the idea that there may be some additional disclosure issues with EIS statements that are more appropriate for have to be dealt with through legislative change, and that may be brought forward by the board at a later time. If you then turn to page 2 in this packet, you come to 4503-0500 on contributions.
Here. Do you think maybe somehow get the mic turned up a little bit?
Mr. Sigerson, you may have to pull that up a little bit like we do during committee and talk a little bit closer to the mic to be able to be heard.
Yes, sir.
Thank you, Senator.
Thank you.
Did it help any?
Oh, much better.
All right. Mr. Sigerson, you don't have to go back to the beginning of your comments.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure if I remember what I said. But anyway, going to 4503-0500 on contributions, here we're trying to catch up the provisions on contributions with the fact that now we have contributions coming in electronically. By electronically, I mean through PayPal or other various ways in which contributions come over a website. The statutory requirement, you may recall, for contributions is that you need to deposit it within 10 days of taking physical possession of a check or a cash contribution. The treasurer has to get it into your committee. Well, with PayPal, I've been told that that's unlikely, in fact, impossible, because in most cases they hold on to that a contribution for at least 6 days, sometimes longer, until they verify that, in fact, the money was provided into that account. So that causes a conflict. We have a statute that says you're supposed to get it within to your account within 10 days, but for 6 to 9 days, the treasurer may not be able to move it to that account. So now we're saying that the 10 days starts from the point at which PayPal releases, or I'm saying PayPal as an example, any vendor like PayPal releases that money to your treasurer so they can move it down. The other question with electronic contributions is how does that apply to the various dates that we have in statute regulating when a contribution is received. For example, the affidavit of contributions, where you have to raise $15,000 or $3,000 by a set date. Well, even though you can't move it into the committee, we believe it's more fair for the committee to be able to count that contribution as long as the contributor press send or okay within that time frame. So in that case, we're looking at the other date. We're saying, okay, it was contributed in time to be counted towards the affidavit of contributions. When the contributor presses okay, same with a sessional contribution. If a lobbyist gives you a contribution over the website, it was given to you the day that they press okay on the transaction, not the day that you can bring it down. So we're trying to reduce problems for both you and for your volunteer treasurer in terms of figuring out are these going to be problems depending on when the date was processed. Lower below on that same section, there's another subpart 10, which is dealing with electronic contribution processors. This again is maybe one of the first points where I'll point out advisory opinions. There are three separate advisory opinions which all basically say the same thing, which is that if you're an entity that does nothing but process electronic contributions and then forward them on to the committee or party unit that they were given to, that doesn't mean that you need to come to register with us as a political committee, because you're not regulating, you're not deciding how that money is being distributed. The reason we had to do that advisory opinion three times is because there were three different companies who had legal counsel who said, hey, that only applies to the person that asked it. I'm going to get safe harbor for us as well. So this is a case where we want to get into administrative rules so that, again, it applies to everyone and there's no question about that. Moving on to page 3, 4503.1400, public subsidy agreements. There were a couple of issues that have come up, one based on advisory opinion, another based on a statutory change, which was appropriate to deal with here in the Ministry of Rule. First is that as a condition of signing the public subsidy agreement, a candidate agrees that they will not then use funds in their committee to make a contribution, or excuse me, to make an independent expenditure for another candidate. In other words, you can't turn around and say, okay, this independent expenditure isn't for me, but it'll be for this other candidate. One of the provisions of the public subsidy agreement says you can't do that. The advisory opinion to the board was, well, can I make a contribution for committee funds to an independent expenditure committee that only makes independent expenditures on, by statute, can only make independent expenditures to other candidates for or against them. And the board believed that there really is no significant difference there. It's just a matter of how it's being routed, and that the real intention of the statute was not to have independent expenditures paid for by committees who have signed the public subsidy agreement. So that's incorporating that advisory opinion. The other issue is that there's a section in statute in 10A which provides for public subsidy payments to any candidate involved with a special election. So if there's a vacancy that comes up during the middle of the year, there will be a filing period. People will file for office. And the other option then of signing a public subsidy agreement, qualifying for that public subsidy payment and receiving the public subsidy payment for the special election. But recently, the legislature put into the provisions of 204B13, which is the special election or the vacancy that occurs very shortly prior to a state general election. This is the type of situation where there is no filing period because the ballots have already been issued. Instead, all of the candidate who will be brought in to replace the person who can no longer go forward doesn't file for office. Instead, the party of that candidate will say who that candidate was going to be. This is the situation with Representative Barrett's position when that became open. The Republican Party provided the candidate that replaced him. Fine, but that has no filing periods, and all of our administrative rules were triggered by filing periods, so this is basically allowing for us to respond to that situation by now going from the date in which the general election occurred as opposed to the filing period. Moving on then from there to the bottom of page 3, there's kind of a long set of rules that deal with disclaimers, and maybe just a tiny bit of background. 211B04 is the statute which provides the general description of disclaimers for campaign material, which we've all been using for years. It's the one that says prepared and paid for by the blank committee address. Everyone knows that. All the printers know that one. It's easy to find. It's easy to use. The problem is that when you do an independent expenditure, 211B04 doesn't say anything about what the disclaimer should look like for an independent expenditure. Now, in 10A17, there's a vague reference that says, well, if it's an independent expenditure, the material should say something to the effect not approved by the candidate, and the candidate's not responsible for the material. But it doesn't say anything else about what should be on the disclaimer. And so staff has been dealing for the last 2 or 3 years in just trying to come up with some sort of idea as to what a disclaimer for an independent expenditure would look like. We believe this is probably the best way forward. There are variations here, but again, subpart 1, 2, and 3 are all dealing with independent expenditure disclaimers that's on written material. 4 is a slight variation because in some cases there's no cost to produce the material. 5 was pointed out to us that we had forgotten about broadcast material, so we certainly don't want to have a disclaimer that takes longer to say than the radio ads. So we've got an abbreviated version here that drops some of the elements out for broadcast media. And then there's 6 is independent expenditures, so there's more than one participant, and so we kind of go through this. All of this, again, is just providing information basically to vendors, frankly, but to a certain extent to independent expenditure committees on what the disclaimer should look like if they decide to produce that material. Subpart 8 is probably of interest. There's always been some question, and indeed we've had complaints filed because there was some confusion over it, as to whether or not it was required for your committee to have a disclaimer on the sessional wrap-up. If your committee paid for the sessional wrap-up and was distributed prior to signing dies, so it's a non-campaign disbursement, it's not campaign material by definition, did you have to have a disclaimer on it saying that, well, my committee paid for it? And this is clarifying that you do not. However, you also recall that the statute says after adjournment signee die, now it's no longer strictly a non-campaign disbursement, and so at that point you would have to have the disclaimer added onto that material. And that's what we're just trying to provide here. Material distributed, a session wrap-up distributed during the session doesn't need a disclaimer. Afterwards, it would. Subpart 9 is dealing with, the statute says that the disclaimer should be conspicuous and prominent, but doesn't have any indication as to what prominent and conspicuous means. And again, we receive a lot of questions from vendors who are trying to figure out if their disclaimer, if their printing is going to match that requirement. And so what we have here is a couple of provisions. We provide a font for written material. We have a font for use on a website in terms of what that looks like. We dropped out a provision after quite a bit of feedback dealing with campaign signs because, frankly, the font requirement for a lawn sign is a heck of a lot different than a font requirement for a highway billboard. And we were not able, even working with vendors, to figure out some way to approach that, at least at this point. We also had a provision in here that dealt with using color as a way of somehow making it prominent. And then we responded to concern that by making it color, you were increasing dramatically the cost of producing that material, which was not our intent. So we have dropped out provisions dealing with color and now are just trying to at least address the issue for written material and web-based material. Further on to page 5, you're going to see this is 45250330, submission to the board. You may recall at the beginning I said that in 2014 the board adopted rules dealing with investigation.
Mr. Gibson, I'm going to interrupt you because as we talked about the format on here, someone had a question. We've kind of transitioned. There was a question on the last topic. Sure. So if we can go to that, Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And what I'm trying to understand is on Subdivision 8, services or communication for constituent, is that vague enough to include? I oftentimes have email communications with constituents, like I have this last week, in regards to some issue. I oftentimes contact other people and then communicate with a constituent. I don't see in here where it specifically clarifies what kind of communications. And since in the writing it says, for a constituent, and I take that as being individual, not plural, why would that not be interpreted that I'd need a disclaimer for every time I communicate to anyone?
Mr. Sigurdsson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Quam, it would be our intent that it would apply to any sort of material that goes out to multiple constituents. For example, again, the legislative wrap-up, who we believe would be covered by this provision. If we can clarify that to, simply make it services for constituents instead of singular, make it plural, that's a simple change, and we'd certainly agree to do something like that if that would help with clarity.
Representative Quam, follow-up?
Just, Mr. Chair, I think some of this gets very problematic because if there's two people living in a household involved with an issue, it's a farm family and the DNR, then it's constituents. And, I think for us to do a service to the people that we represent, I'd like to have it easier for me to contact them on issues. And this and other places, it seems like these rules seem a little bit vague, and it'd be nice if there was maybe discussion in a committee format to take out that vagueness so that we address it before it gets implemented. And that's just what my thoughts.
Mr. Sigurdsson, follow-up response to Representative Quam's comments?
Mr. Chair, Representative Quam, certainly, there are all these rules, again, are subject to improvement. I mean, we would never say that they're finished until they are finished. What we're trying to do with this particular one, actually, is hopefully get rid of doubt that seems to be out there as to whether or not constituent services, if paid for by your committee, understanding that you also do constituent services through your legislative budget, that, of course, is outside of what we're talking about here. But if constituent services paid for by your committee are supposed to have a disclaimer, it's always a matter of confusion. And what we were trying to do here is reduce that amount of confusion. If we haven't quite got to that point of providing that clarity, then we would clearly need to work on that language some more.
Thank you, Mr. Sigurdsson. I think we can go back to 4525.0330.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, again, this is the most recent set of rules that the board adopted in 2014 dealing with the way in which investigations are conducted by the board and what staff does while carrying out those investigations. As a quick aside, I, by the way, say that while these rules were directed to the board to adopt, in retrospect, I think it was outstanding that we in fact did adopt these rules. I think everyone's a lot more secure in the procedures that are used. I think the regulated community is a lot more comfortable, and on occasion staff is a lot more comfortable understanding the various steps that we go through and having those spelled out in a consistent manner. However, during 2 years of experience, we now have found kind of two situations where the rules, as drafted by the board, in fact have probably caused extra work or at least a delay in resolving some issues. None of the changes that you see here are dealing with formal complaints. In other words, if someone comes to a complaint with the board, that's dealt with initially by the board chair, then by the full board through a probable cause hearing, and then eventually through findings after a formal investigation. This doesn't change any of those procedures. But there's a second avenue, a second set of procedures that are used basically under my authority. If a report comes into the board from a committee or from a party unit or a political committee of any type, that apparently shows a violation, for example, an excess contribution, contribution from a prohibited source, session of violation, any of those sort of things where it's reported to us, then I have the authority to do what's called a staff review, which is starting an informal investigation, but it is a form of investigation. In many cases, probably almost half the cases, it turns out that, in fact, the report is wrong and there is no violation. Yes, they initially accepted an excess contribution from that individual, but they recognized it. They returned part of it within the 90 days in which you can return an excess contribution. This is just an example. But they forgot to take it out of the software, and so they reported it, even though it had been done. We get that verified by seeing a copy of the check returning the excess contribution. We get a verification that maybe it wasn't a session of violation because the volunteer treasurer accidentally put down the date of deposit as opposed to the date that they received the contribution. In other words, in many cases, through a simple amendment process, the possibility of a violation is cleared. And under the current rules, I now have to go to the board with a fairly substantial report for each one of those situations. And frankly, that's probably more work than it is justified. If it can be cleared by a simple amendment, then from staff's perspective at least, what should occur is that I simply report those to the board. Here are the ones that we looked at because they looked like they may have been a violation. They were all cleared by amendment. The committee that filed the report is notified that the violation or potential violation has been cleared by that amendment, and we're done. That's a lot simpler process than is currently in rules. The second set you see there is the case where, in fact, there is a violation. I'll go with the sessional contribution as my example. A report comes in. It looks like a candidate took a contribution during the session. That's, of course, prohibited. We verify that that occurred. Basically, the committee, the candidate says, I'm sorry, I don't know what I was thinking. Yes, that occurred. They have a violation. Under the current rules, I then need to go to the board, turn it into a formal investigation, and then come back next month with some resolution of that issue. That seems to be unnecessary as long as the party who has the violation basically acknowledges the violation. In other words, they wrote a letter saying, yeah, you're right, we did it. We're sorry, what do we need to do to clear this? In that scenario, we can draft findings. They still have the right to come in, they being the committee that made the violation, have the right to come into the board when the board considers the findings, and we can address the issue right then and there. We believe on average that will save us 5 weeks on those type of violations and just make the whole process run faster. Committees don't like to have violations hanging over their head. They prefer to get it done quicker rather than later, and we think this will allow us to do that while still providing them the right to address the board and explain how that happened. And that finishes that section, Mr. Chair, for any questions.
Members, are there any other questions on the first set of rules that we were looking at? Seeing none. Representative Fenton, I'm sorry, you're on the list.
Thank you. Mr. Sigerson, so with the, as I'm reading under the investigative portion, so the board currently can investigate either on a complaint or reports filed, is that correct?
Mr. Sigerson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fenton, that's correct.
So, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Sigerson, so is there an opinion on your board or at the staff level that believes the board has broader investigative powers?
Mr. Sigerson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fenton, I'm not quite sure where you're, the question. Maybe I'll try to address it this way. The board does believe that if a complaint is filed with the board saying that, okay, here is a potential violation, or we believe there was a violation, that's what a complaint is. We believe there was a violation of, and they fill in the particular portion of statute related to what they believe occurred. During the course of that investigation, and that's a formal investigation, and the staff, and assuming the board accept the complaint, staff would investigate anything related to that. During the course of that investigation, it is possible that some other violation will come to light. If we go in looking for and I'm trying to think of an example, but if we go in looking for one thing, but by looking at their bank statements and or deposits, it becomes obvious that there was another violation that was not listed in the complaint, the board has always held that it is in fact possible then to look at that other issue. It would be, from the board's perspective, contrary to the mission of the board, which is to enforce the provisions of 10A, to ignore some provision or some violation that was discovered during the course of investigation. If my first answer was incomplete, I apologize. I guess I would say that we have complaints for a specific violation listed in the complaint. We look at the possible violations that are reported to us. And then the third way that sometimes issues come to the board's attention is during the course of an investigation or an audit, some other issue then is raised as you look at the bank statements or other records of the committee.
Representative Benton, follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So, Mr. Sigerson, so essentially, currently the statute, I believe, says you can investigate based on a complaint or a report that has been filed. But in this, in these proposed rules, would you say that that is being extended, correct?
Mr. Sigerson.
Representative O'Driscoll, Representative Fenton, actually, I would not say that. I think the statute provides that within available resources, the board should investigate any issue dealing with Chapter 10A. I believe that's pretty much a direct quote from 10A02 in terms of investigations that the board may address. So from that standpoint, I don't believe these rules expand the investigative authority of the board.
Representative Fenton, follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Mr. Sigerson. I just want to say, I just wanted to clarify that because, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I do see the role of our campaign finance board as being an arbitrator between the complainant, a complainer, and a complainant. And I just, as you go through the rules, I want to caution on what happens suddenly if the campaign finance board becomes the complainant. So I just want to be very careful that that line does not get crossed.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fenn, I would say this. The board is certainly very cautious with the idea of ever starting an investigation that is, I'm trying to think of the term I want to use here, that's based nothing on other than a suspicion. I mean, part of the process that was set up through the legislation and then carried out through the rules that we adopted in 2014 is a three-step process where the board chair, prior to staff even starting an investigation, the board chair has to be convinced that the complaint both lists a, the first part is easy, doesn't actually list a violation of 10A, that's not too high a hurdle. But then secondly, if true, would it still be a violation of 10A, which is a higher hurdle. Then it goes to the board, for the full board, for its consideration as to whether or not there's enough evidence after we get a response from the individuals and or associations that were complained against as to whether or not this still carries any water. And then we only move forward if the full board then votes that a further investigation is warranted. So there are processes in place, I think, that limit the scope of investigations that keep the board from kind of going off and doing investigations I don't want to say on a whim, but basically without some strong basis for doing so. And I think that's set up in statute inappropriately. So.
Representative Fenton, follow-up.
Thank you. Just my last comment. The reason I bring this up, Mr. Sigerson, is we have been dealing with it lately under the Department of Commerce has cost taxpayers over $1 million in legal fees because they were found to operate outside of their scope of their investigative authority as well. So as you go continue with these rules, I urge caution as you go through that. Thank you.
Mr. Sigerson, before I come to you for a comment, or I should say to Representative Mason's question, give you a chance to comment on Representative Fenton's remarks if you'd like to before we move on to Mason's question.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fenton, other than I appreciate your comment, and I'll be sure that the board's aware of that concern.
Thank you.
Representative Mason.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to go back to
Section 8 on the disclaimers, and you had used the example of the session summaries. Now, typically what happens right now is more than, in most cases, we're going to get the session summary out after we adjourn. And I know we always put, you know, prepared and paid for by the campaign. And are you is this making things clearer, more comfortable, going back to, I think, with what Representative Quam was saying, because we still do stuff afterwards, or is it just strictly to things that are, in session subdivision 7, it does say campaign material. Is my question clear?
Yes, ma'am.
Mr. Sigurdsson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mason, what we're trying to hopefully provide here is a little bit of guidance to committees. It's always been the case, and this is statutory, not for administrative rule, that any material that's a constituent service, including sessional wrap-ups, that's issued after sine die for that first 60 days is 50-50 campaign expenditure, 50-50 non-campaign, and after 60 days, it's entirely a campaign expenditure. What has always been unclear, at least from the calls that we receive in our office, is, well, we understand if it's partially campaign material, then at that point it needs to have a disclaimer saying that as campaign material, by definition, it has to have the disclaimer in 211B04, which says, you know, prepared and paid for by the so-and-so committee. However, what happens if that same material, it looks exactly the same, but it's distributed before signee die? Well, again, the statute says, but prior to signee die, it's not campaign material. So therefore, the provisions of 211B04 don't apply. It doesn't meet the definition of campaign material. But that's never, it doesn't seem to be clear, and just from the number of calls that we receive. So we're trying to provide clarity that prior to signee die, that same material, if you get your sessional wrap-up out prior to the end of signee die, that it's not necessary to put a disclaimer saying that this is prepared and paid for by the so-and-so committee, because that disclaimer is only required for campaign material. I certainly have heard Representative Quam's concerns, and we can take a look at that language to see if we can make it better.
Representative Mason, follow-up?
Thank you. Yes, one question. So what my understanding is, the same piece, if I get it out before the end of session, it doesn't need the campaign disclaimer, even though the campaign is paying for it?
Mr.
Chair, Representative Mason, that's correct. Because the way the statute is set up, constituent services are not campaign material until after signee die. And so that's how come you wouldn't have to have your disclaimer on. Because the disclaimer provision, 211B04, only applies to campaign material. It kind of becomes a circle. If it's campaign material, it needs the disclaimer, but if it's prior to signee die, it's not campaign material, therefore you don't need a disclaimer.
Thank you.
Chair Kiffmeyer, followed by Senator Lane, followed by Representative Joachim.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Sigurdsson, my question has to do a little bit, it has to do with those disclaimers as well. But my question more has to do with, have you researched the court opinions, there are several of them, on disclaimers and their nature, when they're to be used, and other things. Have you done an extensive research of those court opinions as part of what you are doing today as well?
Mr. Sigurdsson.
Mr. Chair, Senator Kiffmeyer, I think that we're incorporating the court provisions here. Remember that the court challenges were to 211B04. On two occasions, that statute, I believe, was found unconstitutional because it applied to too low of a threshold. In other words, an individual who prints off 50 brochures on their personal printer, the court has always made it clear, and when I say the court, I mean the U.S. Supreme Court, has made it clear that you cannot require a disclaimer in that situation, and that you have to have a certain threshold. Excuse me. And that threshold is usually the point at which you're required to register a campaign committee in the state that you're dealing with. That provision in 211B04 has now been changed to say that if you're not required to register a committee because your expenditures don't meet a certain threshold, then you don't have to do disclaimers. And that's carried through here as well. If you're not having a level of activity that requires registration in the state, then a disclaimer doesn't provide or is not required. That's the idea that we have here with 211B04. I'll verify with the staff member who's been writing this, but we did have that discussion to make sure that we didn't have a provision for independent expenditures that would not be consistent with the Supreme Court rulings.
Chair Kiffmeyer, follow-up.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I appreciate hearing that, Mr. Sigurdsson, but it is a very dicey area and very important to make the distinction, because there is the free speech rights of our constituents, and it's important for our communications with our constituents. Our ability to communicate with them is very, very important. We can't serve them without communicating. And if the rules and a variety of things are not are put in such a way that it hinders that, I would have concerns about actually inviting more court challenges.
Sure.
And having less clarity than what this is trying to do. And that's just my comment.
Mr. Sigurdsson, any follow-up?
No, sir.
Senator Lane, followed by Representative Joachim. Senator Lane.
Thank you. And I would just like to go back to something that Representative Fenton had brought up as far as, quote, crossing the line. And you were she was suggesting that they should only operate on complaints. But there are situations where they come across something that they need to attend to. For instance, we require them to reconcile donations in one committee with receipts from another committee. And if they find a problem, they need to go forth. And it wouldn't be, as I understand it, on a complaint basis, but on the basis of what they're obligated to do. So there are situations in which it isn't just action on the basis of a complaint, my understanding, and I would check with Mr. Sigurdsson, but we do ask them to do things that go beyond just complaints, and it's not crossing a line.
Senator Lane, my understanding of what you just said is in statute as one of the powers that they have, the way you've laid that out. But I will defer to Mr. Sigurdsson on that.
Mr. Chair, Senator Lane, that's correct. Again, there's the two ways that investigations start, either through a complaint or through our investigation or review, I should say, of reports filed with us. That includes the reconciliation that you're talking about, which sometimes brings to light, for example, more than just a reporting issue where, you know, campaign community X says that they gave $500 to this candidate and the candidate doesn't report it. Well, that's usually just a reporting issue that isn't a big deal, but there's also the possibility that causes a special source violation, and that then becomes a violation that we then move forward on because we've uncovered it through that initial process.
Representative Lane, follow-up. Representative Ewing.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. More of a clarification, maybe, from my understanding, from what Representative Mason was talking about. If there is a session wrap-up that's sent out prior to the 60 days after sign and die, as long as it's not a campaign money was not used and it's just House communication, let's say I send it out through my listserv, my email listserv of constituents that have signed up to receive my weekly updates via email, then that is still, you don't have to have a disclaimer on that because that's House. You're not using campaign funds to pay for it.
Mr. Sigurdsson.
I think that's correct if I understand your situation. In fact, there was a complaint filed basically on that scenario where material was, or a session wrap-up was produced using the budget provided by the legislator to every member. In that scenario, a disclaimer wasn't used. My memory is failing me. I'm trying to recall if that was the only issue or if the secondary issue was when it was distributed. I believe that it was distributed. Yeah, I'm pretty sure that it was distributed after signee died, but there still was no violation because it wasn't paid for by the committee. This would be looking at the use of committee funds for a constituent service that now has gone over the adjournment signee died. That would be the scenario that we're looking at.
Seeing no other questions on this set of rules, hearing none, seeing none, we will move to the second set of rules under consideration by the Minnesota Campaign Finance Board. Mr. Sigurdsson, did you want to let us know which one we should be looking at this time?
Mr. Chair, board members, or three members, this is the expenditure and non-campaign disbursement provisions. The first one is 4503.0850.
Give members a chance to bring that in front of them before we ask you to go ahead and background the committee. They're located that. All right, Mr. Sigurdsson, if you'll go ahead with the presentation on the next set of rules.
Uh, committee members, the first one is 4503.0850 on reimbursements. This, frankly, is dealing with an issue that is to help the board. It's been difficult under the current set of rules to track reimbursements made either to the candidate or to the treasurer from community funds. It's inconsistent in which the way that is reported to us. In some cases, it's reported by vendor, and then underneath that it says that this is a reimbursement. In some cases it comes to us, it says reimbursement to the candidate first, and then underneath that they try to make some explanation as to what was purchased with community funds. And this causes a problem in tracking that, making sure it was reported, and that we understand what's going on with the situation. So this is trying to clarify that itemization of over $200 occurs when an individual is being reimbursed, and then below that you list the vendor, just like you would with any other expenditure. You list the vendor, you list the date, you list the amount, you list what was in fact purchased for the committee. Sandra Kiffmeyer mentioned to me, and I've confirmed this is correct, the current version of the software doesn't support this format, but we started to work with the programmers, and we have no doubt that we can adjust the program so that this is easy for the treasurers to use. We're going to change the screen to accommodate this change in administrative rule, and we think it'll make it both easier for the treasurer to report and also, frankly, for us to track to make sure that reimbursements are being reported to us. Below that is dealing with an issue that's come up and through some investigations, which is how cellular telephone plans are being paid for by community funds. To be clear, there's no doubt that cellular telephone plans could be very well a cost of serving an office that a committee could be, community funds could be used to pay for. But it has to be clear that those committee funds cannot in turn be a conversion to personal use, because in some way it's partially paying for the family plan that the member of the legislature is on. So what the rules provide here is basically two alternatives, and then sort of within that a second alternative. The two alternatives is one, the gold standard probably, is to buy a single user plan and pay for that with committee funds so that there isn't any question. But if there's reasons why that's not a realistic alternative, then there are a couple of different ways of making sure that that family plan is not being partially paid for with committee funds. One is a method of tracking actual data use. The second was acknowledged in a finding issued by the board, which is that basically you take the family plan, divide it by the number of people on that plan. So if you have four people, for example, on the family plan, if the legislator is one of those four, then one-fourth of the bill may be paid for by committee funds. That's probably not as precise as the other alternative, but realistically, and we're trying to understand, you know, a volunteer treasurer who has time to go through a phone bill every single month trying to figure that out. So we believe that we're achieving the goal, which is making sure there's no conversion or personal use. It's clear to the treasurer how they're supposed to do this, and it's a relatively easy process to do. Moving on from there, on the top of page 2, subpart 4 is dealing with mileage. Again, we often see mileage as a reimbursement or a cost that's being paid for by the committee, and undoubtedly that's appropriate sometimes for campaign purposes, sometimes for a cost of serving an office. But when we've done investigations, frankly, at times, the documentation for that mileage has been lacking. And so we did want to set in the rule that to avoid any conversion of personal use, to have documentation that will reassure the public that, you know, the mileage being paid for by the committee is appropriate, you do need to have a mileage log that has the date of the trip, the purpose of the trip, and obviously the mileage that was on the trip. It's not... We don't believe, the board doesn't believe that this is, I suppose I should say the rules subcommittee doesn't believe that that's a particular onerous task, but it will allow you then to document to the board anytime there might be an investigation if there's any question about the type of mileage that's being reimbursed. Below that is the purpose of expenditures for non-campaign disbursements. We sometimes have difficulty getting enough disclosure on the report to verify that, in fact, it was appropriate. This is especially true for non-campaign disbursements where you need to relate that expenditure to one of the purposes that you see in statute for non-campaign disbursements. My example is, and we've seen this a few times, is that, well, I list the vendor, it's Delta Airlines. I paid $500, that's fine, and the item purchased was airline tickets, and that's where it would stop. For I think the public disclosure to be finished so that we know that this, in fact, related to a cost of serving in office, you should also put the purpose for that expenditure. For example, a trip to the NCSL conference in Atlanta or wherever it may be. There are certainly, without question, trips related to legislative duty where you're learning information that will make you be able to serve your public better that are entirely appropriate, but we need to understand that that's what that trip was, as opposed to just kind of leaving it blank as to the purpose of that trip. So we're trying to get more information on that, again, for public disclosure. Below that, when you start the non-campaign disbursements in 4503.0900, there are three new ones, G, H, I, and J. These are all based on advisory opinions. You see the numbers listed there on the side, 415, 424, and 433, excuse me. These are other types of costs that you can use your committee funds for, which are valid non-campaign disbursements. We're talking about recount costs if you find yourself in a recount situation, a single reception for candidates who are retiring from public office, donating to the general fund. You may not think that that would be obvious or that we need to put that into rule, but in fact, from statute, it's not obvious that you can do that. And then we did have a situation where a candidate was unexpectedly quitting to take a position out of state. They felt bad because the special election was going to have to be paid for by the county, so they wanted to give funds to the county to cover the cost. And the board did believe in an advisory opinion that that was a reasonable non-campaign disbursement. So this is, again, putting it into rule so it's available to anyone else who wants to do that. Going past that to page 3. On subpart 4, services for a constituent, again, this is basically based on advisory opinions, 248, 307, and 378. These are things which the board has found are, in fact, legitimate use of committee funds for constituent services. Bringing a charter bus to transport constituents to the legislature for an educational day. Cost of hiring an intern who provides constituent services. Congratulatory letters typically sent to, for example, high school graduates, as long as the letter provides information on government services, perhaps how to register to vote, or some other information where you can say this is, in fact, a service to the constituent. Remember, that's the category that you're going under. It didn't seem to the board that just saying congratulations for graduating from high school, your representative, met that test, but if you're providing information on how to apply for student loans, voter registration, all sorts of issues about government services, then it's appropriate. It is providing a service to those individuals, and you can pay for that. And then the last one is actually going back to what we were talking about earlier, which is the sessional wrap-up. I mean, I'm aware that the sessional wrap-up has been done probably pretty much since day one around here, or so at least since Chapter 10A was passed. But there's nothing in statute and there's nothing in administrative rules saying that that's appropriate. So here in an issue to sort of tie that up, we now say that a sessional wrap-up, recognizing it's a common practice, is something that you can use committee funds for. Under somewhat unrelated below that, you're also going to find that we do say, however, it's not a sessional wrap-up if there's any solicitation for committee funds or request that you vote for the legislator who sends it out. I think that's clearly understood. I don't think we've had a violation on that, but we're just making sure that that's an administrative rule as well. Further down on that same page under B, there are a couple of things which, one of which I just now mentioned, material that advocates for re-election, but also cost of food consumed by constituents when meeting with a legislator. We have seen in a number of cases where the legislator takes out a group of constituents for a lunch. Well, besides the fact that the provision in 10A, which provides that a community can pay for the food and beverage consumed by a legislator if they're attending a meeting related to their legislative duties, that's in statute, but it talks about related to the legislator's legislative duties. There's no reference to being able to purchase food for your constituents. And in fact, although it's not within the board's jurisdiction, 211B13, which deals with treating, would probably say that that was a violation under that statute as well. So we're just clarifying that that would not be an appropriate use of committee funds. If you go on then from there to page 4, expenses for serving in public office. We want to make clear that, and I realize that this is common practice, but sometimes, nonetheless, it's advisable to put this into administrative rule. We want to make clear under number one, this is subpart seven, part one, the cost of transportation, lodging, meals, and other expenses necessary to attend meetings and conferences. One of the reasons that the candidate attends the event is to assist a candidate in performing the duties of the office held. So in other words, again, this is the national conferences where you learn about a legislative subject, and that they improve your ability to serve your constituents. So we think that that's, or serve as a better public official. So we think that's a cost of serving in public office that can be paid for by committee funds. The cost of traveling to the state capitol for scheduled legislative committee meetings and regular and special legislative sessions when those costs are not reimbursed by another source. This is a little bit touchy for some members of the public, so I do want to spend a little time on this. And because, frankly, the board's opinion on this issue has changed over time. The current view of the board, at least the subcommittee, and will be presented to the full board, is that the only reason that you would drive to the legislature to attend a meeting is because you're a member of the legislature, which would seem to be a reasonable cost of serving in office. I understand the argument that says, well, everybody has to drive to work, but most people don't, or at least in this group, there aren't people who are living 60, 70, 80, 100 miles away from their place of work. So this is recognizing that as long as the legislature isn't reimbursing you for your mileage to drive back and forth from your either your home or your regular place of business if you're going from there to the Capitol, that those are costs that you could bill back as a cost of serving in office to your committee. Again, however, remember the earlier rule dealing with a mileage log. You can't just ask for a lump sum payment without some basis. But if you keep a log, that can be used as justification for the reimbursement back to you as a cost of serving in office. Part B is areas, however, and again, these are primarily through advisory opinions, where the board has found that it's not appropriate to say that this is a true cost of serving in office. For example, the cost of meals for staff. We understand that there's sometimes a social obligation for a holiday meal or something to that effect, but it just isn't the type of thing which we believe committee funds should be used for. Two, I think, is going to need some clarification. I've had several people ask me exactly what that means, which probably means that we haven't worded it very well. The cost of membership fees and dues necessary to belong to organizations located in the office holder's district. That, for example, let's go with the Rotary Club. Does that mean that I can't use community funds to pay for my membership in the Rotary Club? No, you can. The board has long held that if you want to say that my election, my ability to be elected is going to be helped by being a member of the Rotary Club, I'm using that as an example, as a member of the Rotary Club, that will get me in front of an audience that's important for me to be elected or reelected, but that's a valid campaign expenditure as long as it's within your district. It's not, however, under this view, a non-campaign disbursement that does not count against your spending limit. That was the issue, I think, for the board, is that if it's in this category, that doesn't even count against the spending limit. I don't think that we necessarily have that very clear. So, yes, you can do it as a campaign expenditure. No, it shouldn't be done as a non-campaign disbursement. Trips that are taken not for any particular legislative a duty, but rather just to build relationships. We don't believe that's a sufficient reason to use committee funds. And then four is, you know, it's unlikely that we're ever going to see this, but sometimes you put rules in to make sure that there isn't a violation. The cost of transportation, unless the individual, the office holder, is a person with a disability, it only applies to the office holder. Now, if you have to bring someone with you for those reasons, that's fine. But otherwise, it's a benefit, or I should say not a benefit, but a proper use of committee funds that's only appropriate for the member of the legislature.
Mr. Sigurdson, I do have one question that I'm aware of. Senator Rest.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Sigurdson, it would be helpful to understand what kinds of expenditures are just out and out illegal, as opposed to how they're to be understood as being non a non-campaign serving in public office or a campaign expense. Now, you've just mentioned the Rotary dues are not illegal. I mean, you can pay for them or for any other civic organization, Lions or whatever, as long as it's characterized as a campaign expense. Is the same thing true, like costs of meals for staff, that the campaign could purchase a meal for a staff person, it just has to be characterized as a campaign expense, or is it the case that campaigns may not buy meals for staff, period? And I think that some of us, I guess, say me, sometimes don't understand the distinction about what is permitted, period, as opposed to just how it must be characterized.
Mr. Sigurdsson.
Mr. Chair, Senator Rest, that's a good point. And to your specific issue, actually, based on the advisory opinion, it would be an inappropriate use of funds, period.
Say that again.
It would be an inappropriate use of funds, period, to take staff out for dinner. The rationale, as I recall, the advisory opinion was that in many cases, staff don't reside in your district, so it's hard to see how that would be a campaign expenditure. And then also looping back to the 211B15 provision that says that if you spend more than $5 on food for an individual, you violated the treating/bribery provision. So we didn't want to go there at all, and that advisory opinion says you just flat can't do it. But
Mr. Chairman, so staff, is that the campaign cannot pay for a meal for a campaign staff person? Or does it mean a legislative staff person who is not acting, let's say, taking a leave of absence and working, which commonly happens, taking a leave of absence and being hired by the campaign as a campaign staff person? Can the campaign not pay for meals for that person in function as campaign staff?
Mr. Sigurdsson.
Mr. Chair, Senator Rest. There are two different provisions that you're dealing with. There is a provision in 10A that says that you can pay for food and beverage consumed by volunteers while they're campaigning. So, for example, door knocking, marching in a parade. I think also clearly the board has accepted the idea that, okay, I'm meeting with my campaign chair for lunch because we have to figure out where we're going to put our lawn signs or how we're going to spend our limited budget. I think those are meeting with a volunteer of the committee and related to campaign expenditure. The advisory opinion that I was dealing with, and we can certainly spend more time making sure it's clear, was legislative staff, not campaign staff, and that it was going to take them out for a team-building event. And I understand that that's a usual expenditure with private funds, but it's not something that the board was, not advisory opinion, but that the board was convinced was an appropriate use of money raised through the PCR program and possibly through the public subsidy mm-hmm. program. So it wasn't willing to go out and say that was an okay use of committee funds, even though obviously you could do it with your personal funds if you wish to.
Senator Rasmussen.
But if you hire someone, whether you know them or not, you hire someone for your campaign staff. The campaign cannot pay their expenses, which would include a meal. Am I understanding that correct? You can pay for other things, but you may not pay as part of their reimbursable expenses for them, in addition to whatever stipend or salary you're paying them. You can't pay for any of their meals if they voucher them.
Mr. Sigurdsson.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ress, no, that's not what I'm saying, and I apologize if I'm confusing that. 211B12 does say that staff expenditures, which include, we're not talking about volunteers anymore, we're talking about paid staff,
yes,
is a legitimate cost for a committee, and I have no reason to believe that the board wouldn't consider that also the cost of the staff traveling around the district, because most districts, require a fair amount of travel. Certainly in greater Minnesota, that can be considerable. And also any food and beverage consumed while campaigning as something that goes towards that individual's reimbursement as a paid member of the staff. Mm-hmm. I don't think there's any problem
that's
there.
Okay.
That's fine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Freiberg, and then Representative Joachim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just wondering about the part dealing with mileage. In subpart 4, this is on page 2, part D, it says, the way it's worded is it says, if mileage is not being paid at the lowest rate used by the state to reimburse its employees, then you have to use the actual cost. I understand that, my understanding was the, you know, I seem to recall that mileage was generally paid for at the IRS rate. And I checked on the Campaign Finance Board website, and it says, 2017, you know, there's a memo on your website that says 2017 reimbursement rate for a use of a personal automobile. It says in there, if reimbursement does occur, the use of a personal car should be paid at the 2017 IRS mileage rate, which is 53.5 cents per mile. I'm just wondering why it's worded in the proposed rule this way about the lowest rate. It sounds like it just should generally be paid at the IRS rate.
Mr. Sigurdsson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, it's the same rate. The lowest rate paid to state employees is the IRS rate. You're right, maybe that is somewhat confusing. But if you look at the provisions of the labor contracts, they always say that the lowest rate that is available to state employees is, in fact, the IRS rate.
Mr. Sigurdsson, before I go, Representative Joachim's question on that, something that I would point in clarification, since you do reference IRS in your written opinions, the IRS does have different rates that are used as well, so you might want to clarify that. For example, if you do charitable work, it's at a much significantly reduced rate than the 53.5 cents. So you may want to provide clarification to which set of numbers you're pointing to, either the state numbers or the federal numbers.
Yeah.
Representative Joachim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just quick clarification, too, when going back to the food and beverage. Say, during session, I do, every 2 weeks, I do an event at the library for constituents, and I bring coffee and I use campaign funds. How would you have to classify that? It wouldn't be for constituent services, but it could be, you can use campaign funds, but you have to classify it a certain way.
Mr. Sigurdsson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I'm getting a little nervous because 11B15 again isn't in the board's discretion, but my understanding of that statute is that for campaign purposes, you can provide food and beverage up to $5 to individuals as long as it's consumed on the premises. That's the wording of that statute. I don't think, though, it's not something that you can say. Remember that the difference between a constituent service and a non-campaign disbursement, which includes constituent services, and campaign expenditures is that campaign expenditures count against your spending limit. Non-campaign disbursements do not. And the non-campaign disbursements are specified in 10A01. We didn't see any of that would fall into that. So I think if you were going to claim that, you would have to view it as a campaign expenditure.
Representative Joachim, follow-up.
So just clarification, this is at every 2 weeks, it's just a coffee conversation with your legislator, and I bring a $10 thing of coffee. Mm-hmm. That would have to be classified as a campaign expense or non-campaign expense?
Mr. Sigurdsson.
My understanding of the Mr. Chair, Representative, my understanding would be that it would be safest to say that was a campaign expenditure because it simply doesn't fall under one of the categories that we currently have for non-campaign disbursements. Obviously, there's always the ability of the legislature to add a new category for non-campaign disbursements that maybe would cover that. But under the current ones that we have available, I don't see how it would fit. I think you would have to say that was a campaign expenditure.
Thank you.
Seeing no other questions, having no other on my list, Mr. Sigurdsson, we'll go to our third set of proposed rules. And as we're bringing those up, members, in your packet, there is also a letter that was submitted from a Mr. George Beck that I would draw your attention to as well. As we said, there's no public testimony to this informational hearing today, but there was some written testimony that was submitted. I do want to draw members' attention to that. And with that, Mr. Sigurdsson, I bet we are on 4503.2000.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I saved the coordination expenditure rules to the end because during the course of our meetings, this was, at least in my view, clearly the most controversial set of or package of rules that we were considering. Coordination rules really is dealing with independent expenditures. And independent expenditures, you may recall in statute, the statutory guidance is fairly clear. There's a very high wall of separation placed between the candidate in any entity that makes an independent expenditure, making sure that there's no cooperation, knowledge between either the candidate, the candidate's committee, any agent of the candidate, in any entity that makes independent expenditures. Nonetheless, over the years, there have been a lot of advisory opinions saying, well, what does that mean in practice? The statute is clear, it builds a high wall, but when you try to move it into the real world, in some cases, it's more difficult. And this is trying to deal with those issues and provide some further guidance so that there aren't violations going forward. The first part I'm going to suggest we can skip forward over, although obviously I'll take questions if there are any issues. That subpart one is just bringing in the definition of candidate from 10801 to say that it's a state-level candidate. We do have election segment and election cycle in here because there is recognition as we go through this. Election segment is 2 years. Election cycle is 4 years for a state Senate candidate. But some of these activities have a timing component. So in other words, if it happened more than 4 years ago for a Senate candidate, it's not something that we're talking about. Something that happens, you know, a week prior to the election might be a problem. Something that happened 5 years ago is not going to be looked at. And then we have some basically abbreviation. Coordinated is the word we're using rather than all the different things that you hear about or that I mentioned in the statute. Spender, rather than saying individual association, political committee fund, et cetera, every time that we reference it, we can just say spender. So really what we're doing here is shorthand. Until we get down to subdivision 9, I do want to take a moment to talk about that because that's an important issue here. Independent expenditures is trying to make sure that candidates are not involved with organizations that make or the funding of independent expenditures, that again that high wall is maintained. That does not include, though, the idea that candidates have no right to be involved with organizations outside of that. In other words, general treasury money is money raised by a nonprofit or other association that is not for the purposes of influencing the nomination or election of a candidate. And I'll have an example of that as we go through that. But that is one definition to maybe keep in mind. If you come over to page 2, coordinated expenditures, this is putting into rule one of the advisory opinions. Again, we're trying to keep that separation between the candidate and an independent expenditure. And what it's saying is that subpart 11, expenditure made. But this would defeat the independence of subsequent independent expenditures. If the candidate was involved within 2 years of raising funds for the use that were used in the independent expenditure that or could be used in the independent expenditure that would benefit the candidate, then that's a problem. So, for example, an independent expenditure committee can only make independent expenditures. If a candidate goes to a fundraiser and says, yes, we want you to, this is a great committee, please donate to this independent expenditure committee, an individual does so, or they receive contributions, and then they turn around and make an independent expenditure for that candidate or against that candidate's opponent, well, that's a problem because they were involved with raising funds or using the independent expenditures, and we believe then that that issue of cooperation has now been defeated or violated, and it's no longer an independent expenditure. An exception is made here, and it's an important exception for party units because we understand that candidates are always involved with raising funds for party units, so we're not including that party units in that prohibition. And it also does not apply, and this is where I mentioned general treasury money. This was brought up by the Realtors Association, who pointed out to me that the Realtors Association has something like 10 or 12 members of their association serving either in the House or the Senate. And they have two different entities. They have the Realtors Association, and then there's the Realtors Association PAC, basically. And so it's not unusual for members to solicit funds, contribute funds, speak at a program of the Realtors group and raise general treasury money that is not used for political purposes. Well, that's not a problem. They're raising money for an association that they belong to, but that money is not raised for political purposes. Now, on the other hand, if that candidate then went to a fundraiser of the Realtors political committee and said, hey, you know, this is great, please contribute, and they turn around and make an independent expenditure for that committee, now we have a problem. So there's that distinction there where we're trying to say members can be a part of an association. They often are members of those associations prior to becoming a member of a legislature. But we're trying to distinguish between raising general treasury money and money that can be used for a political purpose.
Mr. Sigurdsson, before you move on, we do have a couple of questions. We'll start with Representative Swazinski, followed by Representative Nelson. Representative Swazinski, go ahead, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Oh, and
you have our attention, sir.
Back down a little bit there. Just a question. So you kind of spoke, so, you know, as a legislator, you would, I mean, the potential go into a fundraising event. Is it the act of simply speaking at the event or the act of asking for that people to donate to the organization? Because you said, well, hey, if you go to this event and you say, hey, give to this whatever group it is, because they're going to do things, is it if you do that it's illegal under this proposed rule, or is it if you just maybe you speak about legislative issues, regardless of the group? And, like, you know, if it's simply just saying, hey, you should give money to this group, or being there. And, you know, you get asked to speak at a ton of different events, and all of a sudden, you've just given a speech, oh, this is not for general, this is what, I mean, you know, I mean, your schedule's busy enough, you got five things, six things going, it's tough enough just to track every place you're driving it for your mileage reimbursement, but all of a sudden, you spoke to the wrong group, and you're like, oh, crap, like, now you've got a violation, like, how...
Yeah, Mr. Sigurdsson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think if you look at the actual language there in page 2, the first part in a fundraising includes soliciting, collecting, or directing money that's not general treasurer money to the spender. So clearly, I guess the obvious one is you get up and say, please give to this committee, and the committee does an independent expenditure. That's a problem. But I think it would be under these rules you'd then go to C, appearing as a speaker at the event raising money that is not general treasurer money for the spender, emphasizing the general treasurer money. So again, if it's the organization, if it's the nonprofit itself looking for funds, just going up and saying, this is what we've been doing during the session, this is how it impacts this organization, and if there was any sort of that entire meeting was only collecting money for the general treasury of that organization, then there's no problem. On the other hand, if it's the political committee of that association and the only reason that they exist is to collect money that is then used on either contributions or independent expenditures, yeah, that is a problem. It does require, I think, both some awareness of the candidate, and clearly we'll have to make sure that the independent expenditure committees and committee and political committees are aware of this. I would say perhaps I'll leave it at that. I mean, I think, again, that there is trying to make the distinction here between the general organizations where, in fact, you may not be aware that there was any sort of political intent, where you assume that we're just talking about issues. But typically, if it says political committee or fund, which they need to if they're registered with the board, that would be an awareness. Oh, the point I was going to make is it's still actually not a violation for you to make that speech. They take in money for their political committee and fund. There's still no violation unless they make an independent expenditure for you. So in other words, if they don't make an independent expenditure for you, there's still no violation. It's only when you do that last step of them deciding to make an independent expenditure committee for you.
Representative Swazinski, follow up.
So, thank you, Mr. Chair. So, as a legislator, we would have done nothing illegal.
Mr. Chair, Representative, what we're trying to say here is that the I'm not sure which scenario you're looking at, but what we're trying to make sure is that the wall of no cooperation with an independent expenditure committee is has a breach in it. If you're involved in raising funds that are then spent on your independent expenditure, that's the concern in front of the board, is that, well, how can we say there's no cooperation in this independent expenditure between the candidate and the entity that makes the independent expenditure if the candidate was in fact raising funds for that entity? Although it's an extreme example, I'll give an extreme example back. in Minnesota, it's perfectly legal to have an independent expenditure committee that has the name of a candidate in it. In other words, it's a single candidate independent expenditure committee as long as it's separate from the candidate. Well, would you want Senator fill in the blank going to that committee and helping fundraise for that committee knowing that the only thing they're going to spend money on is independent expenditures for Senator so-and-so? That's the issue that we're, that's the extreme, I realize. Mm-hmm. But that's the scenario that we want to make sure doesn't occur.
I have Representative Nelson, Representative Quam, anyone else? I saw some hands heading up over here, Mason. Okay. We'll go to Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my question deals with the general treasury you're talking about. What about if a general treasury, and I'm thinking of the local union, that a portion of their general treasury gets transferred to their PAC fund on a regular basis? If you're raising money for the general treasury, you're actually raising money, in effect, also for the PAC fund. How does that work out? Because also under the Citizens United, in the past, local unions, like businesses, couldn't raise money and give it to candidates or give it to spend it that way. But with your Citizens United, they're now able to use general treasury money for that, where in the past they weren't. So how does that tie into all this?
Sigurdsson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, you may want to recall that even prior to Citizens United, unions were allowed and are allowed to move membership fees and dues into a separate segregated political fund. That is different than the general treasury money is the union membership dues and fees. But the movement of money into the checkoff, the kind of the reverse checkoff that then goes into the segregated fund, is not related to raising money for the general treasury of the union. I mean, I think in that case you would literally have to have a scenario where the candidate was requesting people to give more than their checkoff membership dues and fees to the union, so that somehow a greater amount would be allocated to the segregated fund. Now, I think, in fact, you could probably do that. I mean, funds can receive contributions from individuals other than membership fees and dues. But once you did that, then you're now asking for money to be donated to that fund, and that would be in violation. If you're just out saying, it's important to be a full share membership of the union, that's going into the general treasury account, and that would not be a problem, if that's resolving your question.
Representative Nelson, follow-up?
No.
All right.
I'll think about that.
On the list right now, I have Quam, Mason, Carlson, and Peterson. Did I miss anyone? Okay. Our next question then, Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Director, I'm trying to understand, if somebody generates a multimedia video, puts it online so somebody can go and click on it, and it is about an issue that is highly directed towards a candidate, issue as, I think is the appropriate term, is that considered an independent expenditure?
Mr. Sigurdsson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Quam, no, probably. I mean, the definition of independent expenditure in Minnesota says expressly advocating for a identified candidate. So, one, you have to have a candidate identified, and two, expressly advocating means using one of the basically eight magic words. Excuse me. Vote for, vote against, reelect, oppose. And obviously, I'm forgetting a couple. But there are basically eight words that have come from a Supreme Court decision, Buckley-Vallejo, that says that this indicates to express opposition or support of a candidate. As long as they don't use those words, it doesn't meet the definition of independent expenditure in Minnesota.
Mr. Chair, so someone could generate an expose on that shows a candidate and opens up to some public issue with that candidate. As long as you don't use those words, it's not considered an independent expenditure, even if it's obvious to the common person it's attacking the credibility or that person?
Mr. Sigurdsson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, that's correct. The in the past, the board has had this as an issue, and I think at least in this one, I would suggest in this one narrow area, it might be an area where there could be some discussion again, but you're correct. A piece that avoids those eight magic words but basically says that this person should be in jail is nonetheless not an independent expenditure that is reportable or regulated by the board.
Representative Kwan, follow-up?
No, I would just hope the chair would get some clarification on some of the sharing of donor information so that if a person was involved with an organization or the spouse of a candidate and they said, well, you know, you should call fundraising X, Y, and Z because they're well-heeled, politically active people. If that's a violation, because I know some entities share lists and things get confusing, but if we're adding more verbiage, especially when we're deleting out things that give actual, like reproductions less than $60 or $20, you know, it seems as if we took out some clarifying language and now we're adding something that I think is a little bit ambiguous, even to, members sitting around this table that are somewhat exposed to it. So that's part of my concern, just more information.
Representative Kwan, I think you stated your case very well and the concerns that you have on that.
Mm-hmm.
Representative Mason, followed by Senator Carlson. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a question. My understanding is online it's difficult to get some of the documents that we're using. Is it possible to get all of the documents online so these people that are following electronically can have access?
Are you asking? Yeah, Representative Mason, that information, because these are documents that were provided by the Campaign Finance Board, were posted and made available, to the best of my knowledge, on the Campaign Finance website as well.
Okay. So are they on our committee website or just on Campaign Finance?
You'd have to ask the Senate if they posted them, because I can't speak for the Senate, and as it relates to our House information.
Should be.
They are not currently posted on our website, to the best of my knowledge, Representative Mason.
Can they be posted on on the committee website?
I believe we are working on trying to get some of that squared away. Some of our limitations that we have are with our technology that we have as the legislature, and we have been working on that. I know there's been some concerns that have been shared on numerous occasions with the committee, so and not just this committee, with the legislature as a whole. So we are working on it to the best of our ability as a legislature.
Okay.
And
Thank you.
It's a perennial problem. With that, Senator Carlson.
Okay,
Carlson passes. Representative Peterson, followed by Senator Schiffmeyer. Representative Peterson.
Okay.
Carlson passes.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Wasn't sure since my path is this way. Okay. I just have a quick comment that I'd like to make. As somebody who has been targeted and with independent expenditures, and $1 million was spent on this House seat, so I guess I speak on behalf of both myself and my opponent, that, you know, if I am not able to speak at a event that is in my, you know, livelihood, my work is in real estate. That's how I make my living, and it's a 100% commission job, I might add. So I'm not allowed to speak at a legislative forum to inform my colleagues of what's happening because I'm being targeted out of no reason of my own to speak at something like that, because that would be a campaign violation when I have no idea how they're going to spend their money or whatever. I mean, I'm in a cone of silence for months until after the election, and then it's like, it's great to see you again. I haven't seen you for months and months and months. I've had zero communication. I have no idea what's going on. And I feel like it's like I've lost my speech. You know, maybe other people have all the speech, but where's my speech? I don't get any speech. So that's my comment on that. And then I have a question about the definition of a candidate includes a spouse or a roommate. And how do you hold someone accountable for somebody who has not signed the subsidy agreement? And if these people, so a spouse or, I mean, it says domestic partner, but I don't know how you clarify who that is. It's somebody who lives in the same place as you, and they make a campaign donation to an independent expenditure, are they for in violation?
Mr. Sigurdsson, you've got a lot to go there. Where would you like to start?
Mr. Chair, Representative, the issue that we were trying to get back to here with the being able to participate at meetings, again, going back to the Realtors Association, frankly, we incorporated everything that they asked for. They were concerned about the very issue that you have, which is that they ask legislators, and indeed so much of their membership are, in fact, members of the legislature, certainly have a right to participate in any meeting and express issues dealing with, either the industry or legislation that you're working on. All of that is going to be outside of the issue that we're trying to rein in here through the fundraising, because we don't believe that participating in a forum about what the legislature did for the General Realtors Association of Minnesota or any local chapter has anything to do with independent expenditures, and that's what we've tried to make clear here. So that's not ever going to cause a violation. Now, if you went and made a presentation to the Realtors PAC, and there is such an entity, but it's identified as the Realtors PAC, and frankly, the individuals who run that are very aware of trying to avoid getting their candidates into trouble, candidates they support into trouble, and said, hey, this is the Realtors PAC, please contribute to the Realtors PAC. All right, now it's a little difficult to say that you didn't have cooperation in producing funds that the Realtors PAC then turned around and made independent expenditures to your benefit. That's that second scenario we're trying to provide, to prohibit. The first scenario where you're able to talk about being a realtor either from industrial practice or the practices of the industry or issues in front of the industry, that's totally outside of what we're looking at here. And I'm sorry, what was the second?
About the spouse or roommate.
Okay. We haven't quite got there. Would it be possible for me to address that question when you get to that section? I will certainly explain the rationale.
Representative Peterson, any other follow-up?
No, I'll wait till we get there.
Mr. Sigurdsson, I apologize. I did have to step off for a moment. Where did you leave off before we began questioning?
Mr. Chair, I was going to go with the strikeout provisions, which I think are important to talk about on page 2, part
okay,
D.
So have we done subdivision ones? They do our subdivision 10. They do have some additional questions on that. When you said coming to that, because I wanted to just follow up on something that Representative Peterson had. I was going to ask my question later, but since if this is open for discussion right now,
sure,
because you've already presented that, I'd like to just talk about that. In subdivision 10, the top of page 2, for the purposes of this part, a domestic partner means an individual who shares an interpersonal relationship with a candidate or resides in the same residence as the candidate. Can you define what interpersonal relationship means, either in statute as it relates to this, or is there a board definition on this, or are we just going to go with Webster, or what's going to be our definition on that? Having worked in the interpersonal industry, I can tell you that there's a lot of different definitions of that, so I'm just looking to see which one the Campaign Finance Board wants to adopt for the purposes of this provision.
Mr. Chair, yeah, the domestic partner definition that we grabbed there, frankly, was from a dictionary. What we were trying to do with the interpersonal relationship was to exclude the fact if you were in a scenario where you had multiple roommates, but there wasn't any special relationship other than you were sharing the rent. The only time that we used domestic partner, and I apologize to the representative, I should have just dropped, gone directly to the point where we use that definition. We only use it once. And if you come around to, I have to give me a second to find it.
C.
Thank you. On page 3C, there is a pretty limited scenario you hear, and this is initially brought forward as one of the independent expenditure issues that it was hoped the board would look at, and that's the idea of a independent expenditure committee, or a committee at least that's making independent expenditures, excluding party units. It's always important to remember that we're excluding party units. If that entity has some close family member of the candidate and they make independent expenditures, and that's an important and they make independent expenditures for the candidate, doesn't it seem as a reasonable conclusion that that allows them to have the sort of cooperation that knows how the candidate's committee is doing? I mean, if you're living in the same house and you are more than just a roommate that shares, you know, a bedroom down the hall, then it would seem that much like a spouse, a domestic partner would have the ability to understand just through hearing phone conversations, just through walking people come in to talk about the campaign, of knowing how they could spend the independent expenditures to benefit the candidate. In that, what we consider to be very limited scenario, we do believe that the spouse and the domestic partner is an indication that the independent expenditure, in fact, is not independent, that that's been corrupted by the knowledge that that individual would have about the candidate's activities. Initially, it was a much broader definition than spouse. Frankly, it was many family members. But the more we did that, the feedback that we received was that that was too broad of a brush, that it's one thing to say spouse, it's quite another to say half-brother, who may, in fact, not have lived with the, never have lived with the candidate. So we're kind of focusing on the special sort of relationship, the close proximity that a spouse or domestic partner has to the candidate, and the very strong likelihood that they would have knowledge about the campaign that would then corrupt the independence of any expenditure that that committee would then further make. But remember that the spouse or domestic partner also has to manage, direct, or in some way have high influence on the independent expenditure committee that made the expenditure in the first place. So it's kind of an unlikely scenario, but in that scenario, we would look at domestic partners as the equivalent of a spouse.
Okay, so Mr. Sigurdsson, define interpersonal relationship. I mean, is the campaign finance board going to go and conduct an interview? I mean, I don't mean to be crass when I say this. How do you define that, and how do you know if somebody doesn't disclose that they're in an interpersonal relationship as you're trying to define it here? If I'm a candidate and I find myself in the situation, I suspect I'll be calling you and you'll be saying, well, I have to ask the board what the definition of that means. We'll get a board opinion on that. In the meantime, my campaign is potentially being hampered because you don't have a definition for me to be able to apply to comply with the proposed promulgator rule here.
Mr. Chair, I think, of course, one solution would be to drop out domestic partner and just go with spouse, which I think is a definition that we all know what it means. Our thought, and perhaps it's perhaps it's not doable administratively, is that, frankly, there are a lot of people who aren't married anymore. And so to somehow give them a benefit of the doubt that they won't have that same knowledge or won't be imparted with the same knowledge as a spouse would didn't quite seem fair. But if we have got ourselves into a definition bind that where we can't define what we're talking about, then we should probably just drop back the spouse.
Mr. Sigurdsson, you know, in 10A, I don't know if statute even opens up discussions on spouse and whether they can be regulated or not on here, and it seems like we're trying to define spouse, domestic partner, interpersonal relationship. And in addition to that, I would say that post the decree of dissolution of a marriage in the state of Minnesota, one partners or former spouses could be very positive relationship and a very friendly relationship. And why would those not be covered? And it seems like we're just saying it's easier to define those who are married, but we can have the same things that Joe and admission that a lot of people aren't getting married that could happen elsewhere. I see this as being problematic, and I think at your board, if successful in promulgating such rules, is going to have a lot of work ahead of them in dealing with this and potential litigation too, not against you as the director, because you'd be following the direction of the board, but the individual board members could be opening themselves up to individual litigation as a result of something like this as well, because you're simply following as a staff member the direction of your board. With that, Senator Kiffmeyer.
Well, Mr. Chair, I just want to be sure that we are in this area, and I think I am. I would rather Mr. Sigurdsson could go through the whole set, and then we could do that. But we are on the subject, though, in particular here right now,
of the thing. And so what about caucus leaders who are routinely going out and raising money for their caucus and then are in the situation of possibly benefiting from that independent expenditure? Puts them in a difficult situation retroactively or prospectively. My gosh, how would you ever possibly sort that all out with this kind of language? But could you just speak to caucus leaders and what they routinely do in regards to their duty as a caucus leader, whatever party?
Mr. Sigurdson.
Mr. Chair, Senator Kiffmeyer, that's why we have the exclusion of party units. Remember, caucuses for both the Senate and the House are, in fact, political party units, and that's why we excluded fundraising for party units or involvement in a party unit from these definitions, because we recognize that party units are, frankly, an entirely different animal.
So that is the change?
Chair Kiffmeyer.
Mr. Chair, Senator Kiffmeyer, no, we've always looked at party units as something that that we were going to treat differently. We have always acknowledged that certainly candidates are raising funds for party units all the time.
Chair Kiffmeyer?
Well, I just remember our conversation previously when we went over this in this kind of a scenario, and it was, I don't think it was quite that clear. Oh. So, nonetheless, if we could finish, then we can.
Mr. Sigurdson and members, we did get started late. It's 5 minutes after four, and we probably got started about 17, 18 minutes after our posted time, so I'm willing to go for another 15 minutes or so to make it the 2 hours. And Representative Freiberg, you have a question. Is it on the current topic, or should we let Mr. Sigurdson finish and then kind of cycle back for final questions? You're not sure the nature of your question.
Sure. It actually relates to Senator Kiffmeyer's question. She just got me thinking about caucus leaders. I mean, going back, and it actually goes back more to the previous rule when we were talking about mileage and that sort of thing. So when, you know, when we were distinguishing between campaign and non-campaign disbursements, if somebody is a caucus leader and going out, is that potentially a non-campaign expenditure if they're, you know, it's coming about because of their service in the legislature, but it doesn't directly benefit their campaign, it benefits the caucus, their caucus. When she flagged that issue, it just made me think of that.
Mr. Sigurdson?
Mr. Chair, Representative, there is a provision in the non-campaign disbursements which talks about there's two answers. Cost for legislative leadership in doing their, carrying out the duties of their office. So I think there's recognition that caucus leadership has some expenditures that a regular member would not have. Secondly, we're talking about the expenditures paid for through, and at least I think in your example, through the committee's funds. Remember, the caucus certainly has their own ability to reimburse individuals for their travel. So if the party unit wanted to pay for the caucus leader's tour of the state or whatever the case may be, that would be something that could be done as well. So, I mean, it'd be whichever way that they want to approach it.
Mr. Sigurdson, I'm going to go ahead and give you the chance to kind of finish up your comments, and there may be a few other questions on or a couple of wrap-ups just to help manage the time for folks here. So I'm going to turn it back to you, sir.
Sure. Mr. Chairman, we're on page 2, and I think Representative Qualm indicated something here which I want to make clear. The strikeout that you see in B isn't striking out existing rules. This is the last version that came out of the Rules Subcommittee. Prior to that, this was, in fact, a recommendation from the Rules Subcommittee. But what this is dealing with here, to simplify it down with recognition of running out of time, is the whole issue of using campaign material produced by the candidate by an independent expenditure committee, for example, a YouTube commercial, or a commercial that's developed by the candidate and then it's put on YouTube. If an independent expenditure committee then takes part of that YouTube commercial, this rule was going to say that then defeats the independence of the expenditure. The more we thought about that, the more problems there was with that approach. Now, I'm not saying that the issue goes away. Frankly, I think that someday that issue will be before you. But the one time that the board faced that issue in a complaint, it came up with a conclusion that is pretty much diametrically opposed to what we were providing in rule, which right there indicates to me that the board is still trying to work through that issue. It's a very difficult issue. Many states are battling with that issue. And so it was just an area where, at this point, I asked the subcommittee to not go forward with that. It may very well be something that comes forward as a part of a legislative recommendation, but it doesn't seem to be a place where we have consensus, and I do believe that the administrative rule process is filling in the gaps with pretty clearly defined statutory guidance and or at least advisory opinions that show what the board is thinking. In this case, I don't have either, so we're simply dropping out of that subject area.
Could you clarify?
Mr. Sigurdsson.
Would you just clarify again exactly what you're speaking to, because you're starting out now, so would you clarify what you meant by that, probably dropping?
At least in terms of, Mr. Chair, Senator Kiffmeyer, B will not be part of the recommendation that the subcommittee brings to the full board.
That's stricken.
That's correct.
So you are on page 2, Mr. Sigurdsson, subdivision 11, striking number 2. So that will be the new B that we're seeing on the bottom of page 2 is where we're going to be picking up. Is that
right? The B that, Mr. Chairman, the B that it struck out was at one point an area that we were trying to develop an administrative rule on. But again, through the various feedback that we received, it just doesn't seem to me that this is the time and place to do that. So it's a topic that we are not going to be recommending to the full board.
Very good. Continue on, sir.
On the bottom of page 2, the issue is there are only a limited number of vendors in the state. Typically, they are affiliated with one party or not, but even if they're not, there are a limited number of vendors that develop campaign material in Minnesota. If you go to the extreme of independent expenditure, you could argue that vendor shouldn't be able to do both campaign material and independent expenditure material. And there's been a couple of advisory opinions that you see referenced there of asking the board, is that really true? Are you really trying to, frankly, put us out of business? And the answer is no. You can do both campaign material for candidates and material for independent expenditure committees, party units, who's ever doing the independent expenditure, as long as you follow these steps, which is basically providing a way for them to develop an internal firewall so that staff that it's working on candidate material is not the staff that's working on independent expenditure committee material. But the staff that is producing, you know, it's dealing with the video for producing the video for a candidate's material isn't sending that material over to be used by the independent expenditure committee side as well. So the procedure is, or the steps, I should say, that you see at the bottom of page 2 and forward, excuse me, to the top of page 3, C, D, and E, are basically the steps necessary as prescribed in those advisory opinions so that those vendors can continue to be operating on with both sets of clients. C, I think we've already talked about. This is, again, looking at the issue of that the candidate can't be have direct advantaged or established a political committee within the same election cycle. Remember, a cycle for a Senate candidate is going to be 4 years, 2 years for a House candidate. So if the individual, whether they had signed up as a candidate or not, was running and had created a political committee that did independent expenditures, and then they suddenly decide to, after setting that committee up, to leave the committee and form their own committee for an office, that's going to be a problem if that first committee then makes independent expenditures for that candidate. It's going to defeat the independence of those expenditures. And then when you get to D, E, and F, I think this is probably all ideas that everyone knows already, but there was a couple of advisory opinions asked of the board just to verify. Basically, it's not an independent expenditure if the candidate gives information to this vendor. In other words, if you tell them about what you're doing and they use that to help form their independent expenditures, it's no longer independent. If you give them information on a survey that helps them form a more, that helps them direct what their independent expenditure is going to look like, well, then it's no longer independent if you're cooperating with the committee or the agent of the committee. So I think that D, E, and F are fairly widely known, and I don't think we have a big problem there. But again, we are asked to advisory opinion, so that means that there may be some confusion about it. G is also being struck out. Again, this was the initial thought of the initial version was that we're going to try to develop a rule that dealt with the issue of the reverse of what we talked about with the YouTube. How about if a candidate sees an independent expenditure that's made by either a nonprofit corporation or a for-profit corporation, remember under Citizens United that can occur, and they want to use that and then claim it as their own, so they capture it off of YouTube or some other format. Well, the problem with that is that for all of these issues, if it's not an independent expenditure, in other words, if the independence has been violated, it's now an approved expenditure, which is a type of in-kind contribution to the candidate, which means that you have probably an expenditure limit problem, possibly a contribution problem, and from the corporation standpoint, a really big 211B15 problem, which says that corporations cannot make contributions to candidates. Remember, they can make independent expenditures, but if they make a contribution to a candidate, that has both criminal and civil penalties attached. And that just seemed, again, to be outside of our scope. Setting up a possibility of a criminal violation through this rule just didn't seem to be where we wanted to be, so we struck that and are no longer considering that portion, which you see at the bottom of page 3. And then quickly on the top of page 4 to wrap this up, there are, however, always questions about, well, what can we do that doesn't defeat the independence of a independent expenditure? And one is that you can ask someone not to run it. And we have always been asked on many occasions by a candidate, somebody's running an independent ad against my opponent, it's an embarrassment. Can I ask them to stop? Yes, you can. That doesn't mean that you violated the independence. You can obtain a photograph of a candidate from a publicly available source or public event. So if you go to their website, there's a nice portrait. You grab it, use it in independent expenditure. That's fine. I think some of these are fairly obvious. You can have a hyperlink on your website saying, you know, we're really in favor of this candidate. This is independent. If you want to know more about the candidate, here's a hyperlink to their website. We don't think that violates the independence of the expenditure. And then the G is dealing with the idea of, well, what if I get a survey asking for my opinions on various issues, and that survey is then used to determine whether or not they're going to make an independent expenditure. Participating in the survey doesn't violate or doesn't degrade the independence of the independent expenditure, but may result as the basis of how you answer the survey. That was a lot. Thank you for your patience as I work through this.
Sigurdsson, at this time, I don't have any member questions that have come in, but I will certainly take member questions if we have them. Representative Jessup.
My apologies, Swan. Dr. Sigurdsson, I've only gone through this campaign process twice, but both times, it has been like the fear of God to have any interaction with any independent expenditure. Mm-hmm. And so you flee from anything that could come close to this nature. Is there circumstances that we have observed that are leading to why these rules are being proposed?
Mr. Sigurdsson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Jessup, I would answer yes for two reasons. One, the number of advisory opinions asked by the board of what does this statute mean? I mean, anytime we get an advisory opinion on independent expenditures, it's taking what seems to be a fairly high wall set in statute and saying, yeah, but what about this? There are always going to be cases where we think it's better to provide that answer to everyone who's, again, covered by that similar circumstance. So I think one of our major focuses that we have is that advisory opinions, and there's about 435 of them, are not regularly known by people who are, other than staff, who does know about them. So it's just better to try to move those answers into a wider forum, which we believe is the administrative rules. At least, you know, frankly, at least the legal community knows to always check the administrative rules to see if there's an answer there. Secondly, in terms of major violations, two out of the three largest violations the board has ever dealt with was dealing with independent expenditures. That leads me to conclude that even in the best of circumstances, there can be violations because there's confusion about what is or is not appropriate. And so the more information we can provide through administrative rule or through any other means is going to be beneficial to the regulated community. I think in most cases, perhaps I'm naive, but I think in most cases the regulated community has no interest in appearing before the board. They're trying to get an independent expenditure that truly is independent. And candidates, as you say, when we do compliance training, we always get kind of a pale audience when we start talking about the penalties for independent expenditures because they're significant. So, you know, we're aware of that. We're trying to make it as clear as possible so that violations can be reduced.
Representative Jeff, a follow-up? Seeing no other questions, I just have a few comments, and I think Chair Kiffmeyer has a few as well. I'm sorry, former Representative now Senator Lane. Oh, I almost got in trouble on that one.
Thank you. I would just like to make a comment about the domestic partner. It seems to me that the most of interaction that I have with the board is call with a question. And if I would ask a question, for instance, is it an independent expenditure for my domestic partner to do such and such, I would want an answer, and this would be clear that the board would say, if that person, is that person a domestic partner, and you would say yes or no. And then they would say, well, we consider that a close relationship like a spouse, therefore we would, the advice is no, you may not make a independent expenditure, they may not make an independent expenditure because that would be, that needs to be not coordinated with you, and they're too close to you to say they're not coordinating with you. So it would be an opportunity to ask the question, get the answer, and have it clear that they could give that answer because it was clearly here. Sometimes, what is a domestic partner? Ask them.
My final comments to Mr. Sigurdsson, first and foremost, thank you for being here with us today. It is not an easy task to sit for 2+ hours in front of a legislative committee and have people firing questions at you, so I thank you for your time and being here today. My thoughts are, it is my hope that the board will put this into a slower lane, and taking into consideration the comments that were shared. We may be looking to try to solve a problem that the campaign finance board doesn't have full jurisdiction. I point out again the 10A issue where spouses aren't in there, and now we're going to be bringing spouses into some of these things. My question becomes this for the board to consider on that very single issue. If that domestic partner, spouse, whatever the case may be, chooses not to participate and says, I'm not going to do that, what leverage do you have to force them? It's the candidate's issue. I don't know if we've fully vetted that issue. I think there's a lot of things that we need to be looking at. I'm encouraged by the fact that you are also looking to try to bring forward some legislation to work with the legislature on some of these matters. I do believe that last year's state government finance bill had a number of your non-controversial items that were included in Senator Kiffmeyer and Representative Anderson's bill. I voted for that bill. We were able to work through some of those kinds of things. Remember that the jurisdiction comes from the legislature to help you to be able to do these kinds of things. And again, I don't want to put your board into a situation where they can individually be held accountable for taking actions that they can't. Again, you are the director. You're acting at the discretion of your board. I want to make sure that we're not wasting taxpayer dollars on unnecessary litigation. So some things I would just share as some final comments. And with that, I'll turn it over to Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you very much, Chair Driscoll, and I also appreciate your being here today and the time that you've taken to meet with us separately as well as being here today. But I also share Chair Driscoll's concerns as well, and my additional comments are that when I think of an advisory opinion that says, what does the statute mean, I think the logical next step is to go to the legislature and clarify the statute. The broadest, the most widest input will be through the legislative process, not through advisory opinions and not through rulemaking. And rulemaking is not for good ideas. Legislation is more the process where if you think something is a good idea. And I think that is something that as a board, especially the Campaign Finance Board, which has a strong history in the past, I think of doing that and being very careful about that is something that's really important. And I certainly don't want a board being in the position of deciding relationships and going, I mean, where does that ever end if you start going down that route? And I know that I have some girlfriends and we have other people that on some of these campaign areas can know a lot more
about what you think about issues. And so making those decisions and trying to do that, I think, is going into setting things. Probably the biggest thing, though, is that rules are meant to not to establish new policy, but rather clarifying existing law. And my concern is, where do you get to the point of where you're not clarifying existing law, but now you're trying to clarify advisory opinions from rules, from statute. Now you're getting, that trail starts going quite afar from clarifying statute, which is the original purpose for rulemaking, is only to clarify statutes. And in those cases, I believe they should really be non-controversial. And I think, as we showed in the last legislative session, we of the legislature and the legislators in general were quite capable of going through that process and coming alongside you as a board with a lot of input, the best that you can have in the legislature itself. I think that's really important. One of the things I just want to say is that on these coordination rules, the legislature already has a very clear definition of an independent expenditure. It's actually quite clear. Matter of fact, it appears in three places. 10A01, subdivision 18, 10A.20, subdivision 6A, and 10A01, subdivision 4. So it's very clear that statute already is currently clear. So if you have that, now you're going into coordination rules that goes beyond that and adds to that. And so I think that's, matter of fact, the concern I have and I've expressed before is First Amendment rights being infringed when you go too far. And that's always a little bit of the balance that needs to be considered. So I think that's what I think is really important right now, and then I would join in sharing Representative Chair Driscoll's offer to you as a board as well, that you consider taking probably all of these and think about that as far as legislation and bills to come before the legislature, and that we have demonstrated before not only our willingness but following through and getting them enacted into law, and would reaffirm that I think that is a good spot to go to again is to the legislature. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you to the House.
Thank you. I want to thank the staff for being here and helping us today. I want to thank the members for being here. And thank you, Mr. Sigerson. Thank you for your time. No other business before the committee. We are adjourned.